Blog Talk Radio.
That's right, everybody. You know who it is. Coach Mike Jones on the coach with the most. Coming at you hard from coast to coast. I don't want to boast, but now I got to roast you in my social media posts. You double dose, undiagnosed. You feeling tired, life expired, now you're a ghost. I'll be your host, so won't you raise a toast to the coach with the most, Coach Mike Jones.
The Coach Mike Jones Show podcast, episode 74, here on Super Wild Card Weekend. Here with my co-host for today, the one who's so fly is going to take you sky high, Sign Guy. How you doing, brother?
A little cold today, Coach.
It is cold. Nothing like over there in New York, I'm sure. Why don't you introduce our guest and ask him the first-timer question, please?
Well, our guest today is a longtime fan of wrestling, wrestling personality. He was associate producer on the movie The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke. Evan Ginsberg, welcome to the Coach Mike Jones podcast.
Thanks so much, guys. I'm grateful to be back. Glad to be back.
Thank you so much.
Well, Evan, for the fans that may have forgotten or are unaware, can you tell us, how did you first get involved in professional wrestling?
I've been a fan for over 50 years. I'm 107 years old today, and that's an exaggeration, but I started watching wrestling in the early 70s. My first match I attended was June 24, 1974, 50 years ago, literally 50 years ago, Madison Square Garden, Nikolai and Lassie against Bruno and Jay Strongbow was the feature, and the co-feature was the Valiant Brothers against Dean Ho and Tony Garea, and I just became an avid fan and a sheet writer and later a sheet editor, and one thing always leads to another, and that led to radio, and that led to booking various legends. So at some point, there was Nikolai, who I booked on occasion. There was Johnny Valiant, who I served as his manager, and we were on the road everywhere and anywhere. And one day I had Nikolai and Johnny booked for an autograph signing at a wrestling store, and the best friend of the executive producer, the money guy on The Wrestler, walks in and he says, quote, "You guys would be perfect for our movie. We're doing a movie on professional wrestling." And this was just during the script stage. You know, this was very early. So, you know, we exchanged numbers, business cards. I don't really think much of it. And months later, I'm sitting at a meeting with Darren Aronofsky, Scott Franklin, the executive producer, the screenwriter, et cetera, so on. And I have with me Nikolai, Johnny, the late Tiger Khan, who wrestled for the Hearts up in Calgary, Nikita Breznikov, who was Nikolai's shoot manager, and we just all hit it off. We hit it off, and next thing I know, I was the associate producer on The Wrestler, which basically meant I was the wrestling guy. I brought in Mickey's stunt double. I brought in the ring. I did set design for that sad autograph scene, you know, et cetera, so on. And that's a long-winded answer to your question. 50 years involved with professional wrestling, one way or the other.
Wow, man, we thank you so much for your time and for today's interview. And, man, I'm so grateful to have you on, because just for all that you've done in the history of wrestling that you've helped with your pages on Facebook and all you've done, what are you up to right now?
Well, I'm building my Evan Ginsberg's Old School Memories Facebook page and updating it 10, 12 times a day with all kinds of classic clips and content. And, you know, the old school fans come out of the woodwork. It's interesting. A lot of them, once Vince Jr. took over and it kind of went full circus, a lot of the old school fans dropped out. So when they find a page like this, and they, oh, my God, there's Pedro Morales. There's John Tolos. There's, you know, Bruno. Bruno's like, you know, held in reverence with the old school East Coast fans anyway.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
Harley Race. There's Harley Race, the greatest wrestler on God's green earth. And, you know, it's just like a nostalgic trip. So I'm building that page. I'm writing a book on John Tolos, with Dr. Mike Lano, who was a close personal friend of John's. And when I was a kid in New York, we would get the LA TV tapings every Wednesday night. So even though I was in WWF territory, you know, I watched the LA tapings and also the Florida tapings we got on TV here. So John Tolos was like a god to us, you know? And then Tolos came into the Garden to wrestle Bruno. That's how, you know, big a star he was. So I just grew up on that guy. And he was one of these unbelievable heels who, average-sized guy, you know, in good shape, but an average-sized guy, you know, regular-looking guy. But, man, could that guy talk? He could talk you into a seat. You would buy a ticket to see John Tolos, face or heel, you know? And so it was just I basically do things from the heart. The Wrestler was from the heart, you know? I'm sitting with Aronofsky one day, the director, Darren Aronofsky, who's a genius. Aronofsky's a New Yorker. His mom was a school teacher, you know, and regular guy. And I'm sitting with him one day, and we had just met with Nicolas Cage because we could not get the funding we needed with Mickey Rourke's name. We just couldn't get the money. At the time, we shot in 2008. This was in 2006, 2007 when we were, you know, doing all the preliminary work on it. We would sit at funding meetings and Darren asked for $18 million, and which sounds like a lot of money, but that's really a small indie. And they gave us a third of that, $6 million. So just to put this into perspective, that's like the food budget on the Avengers. Okay. If you're making a superhero movie. All right. So we would roll into indie shows, and I connected them with Ring of Honor, Kerry Silkin. I love Ring of Honor. And so we would start shooting at live cards because we couldn't afford, you know, the extras. These were real fans for the most part. Yeah, you know, they threw me in one of the scenes, but, you know, for the most part, it was fans. So to make a long story short, the Ring of Honor fans are hardcore serious fans, and they were like getting – they didn't want us there. You know, so at one point, Aronofsky actually gets in the ring. Please, let me do one or two more quick takes. We'll get out of here. We're gonna you know, make you proud. We're going to do something, you know, you'll be proud of. And he did. Darren, to his credit, Like I started to say, we met with Nicolas Cage and Darren, who at the time was in his 40s and he was in great shape and he looked healthy. And Darren goes, he's not the right guy. Mickey's the right guy. Mickey looks like he's been to hell and back. Okay. Mickey Rourke was top box office in the 80s. Diner and, you know, various, you know, he was a sex symbol. He was a top, you know, romantic lead in the 80s, and he leaves to go box. The guy's punched in the face. You know, this is not your usual trajectory for a movie star. Okay. So he looked the part. Darren rolled the dice. He's like, Nicolas Cage is much more box office. We have a better chance with Nicolas Cage, but we're going to go with Mickey. I'll never forget. I was sitting alone with him when he said this to me. And we basically shot this low-budget film. And jump ahead a few years. I'm at Lincoln Center, beautiful, beautiful venue, New York Film Festival, one of the most prestigious film festivals in the world, and 2,300 people are sitting there, $40 a ticket, sold out, and I'm sitting in the audience, you know, watching like everybody else. I hadn't seen the cut of it yet. So I had been on set when they did that really sad autograph scene and nobody showed up. I don't know if you remember, the movie came out, you know, 14 years ago, but there's this really sad scene where there's an autograph signing convention and there's nobody there, which is based on a real incident. I took Aronofsky and the crew to an autograph signing, and it's like the WWE Hall of Fame. There's Moolah, Mae Young, Albano, Nikolai, Iron Sheik. There's nobody there. Nobody there. It was really pitiful. And they wrote that into the script. So I'm sitting in the audience at the New York Film Festival, and all of a sudden, there I am on the screen. And my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she looks at the screen, she looks at me, she goes, that's you, that's you. How surreal this is, okay? So when we shot that scene, I'll give you the short version. When we shot that scene, I was just on set, just hanging out, and I did a little set design, so the tables at the convention looked authentic with a lot of, you know, real wrestling merchandise. You know, Darren liked the authenticity. And a lot of that merchandise was my merchandise that we had worked shows with. But anyway, so Darren gets this smirk on his face and he goes, Evan, come here. I go, yeah. And all of a sudden he goes, Evan, I want you to walk up to Mickey last and ask him for an autograph and a Polaroid. So now he has me acting. I've never acted in my life. This is how creative this guy is. He just gets an idea and he rolls with it. So Mickey walks over to me, whispers in my ear, and he goes, just improv it. Just improv it. You know, he thinks I'm an actor. I'm there as a producer. He thinks I'm an actor. So I do exactly what Aronofsky says. There's like 125 people there. There's these giant cameras in my face. I've never acted before. And basically everybody sitting there were actors who looked rough. They looked like wrestlers. But Manny Yarborough was a sumo. He's gone now. He was a legitimate wrestler. And Johnny Valiant was there as one of the guys at the table, but Johnny Valiant didn't have the dyed blonde, you know, Valiant Brothers hairdo. He was gray at the time. So I walk up, to make a long story short, I walk up to Mickey and I'm thinking the whole time, what do I say? And, you know, he said improv it. And Aronofsky didn't give me a script. So I walk up to him and I think, what would I say to any famous wrestler? And I go, I loved you as a kid. I saw you at the Garden, Madison Square Garden. Can I have your autograph? And he looks at me, and he's improvising it, and he goes, what's your name? So now I'm thinking, and I go, Evan. I go, Evan, how surreal this is. I'm playing myself in a fictional movie. And this was all spontaneous. So, you know, so to jump back ahead, there we are at the New York Film Festival. And, I, you know, I'm up on the screen and I'm like marking out because it's like just bizarre. The whole thing's bizarre. And we get and I look around the audience during the scene where he says to his daughter, "I'm just a broken down piece of meat," and everybody's crying. Everybody's crying. And
yeah.
we had put about 7 years off and on into this movie, 7 years. And I'm sitting there going, my God, this works. It works. You can't fake crying. They're all crying. And the movie ends. We get a spontaneous standing ovation. It's a major film festival. There's paparazzi everywhere. And I tell people to this day, I go, that was the best night of my life. That was the best night of my life. And so jump ahead, and ironically, another Darren Antola, comes to me, and he wants to do a documentary called 350 Days. And my first instinct is, well, why would I do another wrestling movie? You're never going to top The Wrestler. You're just never going to top The Wrestler. So he starts talking to me, and I could see the guy's like, his heart is in the right place. He's going, I grew up on Don Morocco and Jimmy Snuka, you know, and Piper, and I love these guys. And, he, you know, he's thinking just like me, you know. So next thing I know, I'm a producer, an associate producer on that as well. And that film is one of the most successful wrestling documentaries ever made. Millions and millions of people have seen it in the 5 or 6 years it's been out. And also something that we're proud of, because I said to Darren Antola, I said to him and his partner David Wilkins, I said, business partner, I said, guys, we don't need another documentary with the fanboys, with the action figures, you know, with the training schools. That's all been done a million times. I said, let these guys, and these are like the biggest names in the history of wrestling. You got Bret Hart, Billy Graham, Valentine, Santana, Orndorff, you know, Mosca. You know, there's like three dozen legends in this. And I said, just let these guys pour their hearts out. Let them pour their hearts out. And next thing you know, they're talking about being on the road and being unfaithful to the wives and, you know, and pain. It was almost like being in a therapist chair, what they were doing. And I said to them, a movie where a old lady who never watched wrestling would cry. I said, that's the movie you make. You don't need another shoot interview. There's been a zillion shoot interviews. I said, make something that's human interest. The wrestling fans are going to watch it anyway. And we were very proud of the way it came out. I don't mean to do a monologue. You guys, please talk.
Yeah. Definitely, what a blessing, you know. And, man, I want to say, man, I admire you so much, Evan. And like you've said before, it does seem like WWE is trying to kill you. And I hope one day that I could achieve half of what you've done in your lifetime. That would be an accomplishment to me if I could do even half as much. You're the only guy I know that's seen more concerts than me.
I love my music.
You've wrote more books than the one you're doing now, and you've done more movies too, and you've been a music producer or a promoter also, and you had your own show. Tell us all about that.
As a kid, my parents, I'm very grateful to them. They love music, and they would take me to see, during the 1970s, some of the greatest acts in the history of music. The Spinners, Ella Fitzgerald, Buddy Rich. I mean, they love jazz and R&B, and, you know, they had good ears for parents. And I just love music, and many, many years later, I became a club booker, and I was booking bands nightly, and that was an interesting experience, the good, the bad, and ugly of that. Working in clubs is tough. It's very tough. You could have a club packed on one night, empty the next night. The elements in a place like New York, when I say the elements, the weather, you have a snowstorm or something, and the club doesn't make money for days or whatnot. And it's a very tough business. And I haven't done that in a while. I would say a good 10 years or so. But you met some tremendously talented people, and what you guys know already is, rich and famous and talented are not necessarily the same thing. There's many, many, many tremendously talented indie wrestlers out there who don't make WWE or AEW or New Japan or whatnot. They just don't make it for whatever reason, and it doesn't mean they don't have the skills. Sometimes somebody's in the right place at the right time, or in wrestling there's nepotism or whatnot. And it's who you know, or in the old days, the casting couch. But,
yeah.
But I don't mean to laugh, but that's the reality of it. And same thing with music. You could be tremendously talented and just never hit. And what's happened today, and this is wrestling and music, ageism. I once had this tremendously talented 16-year-old singer that I wanted to pitch to this record company. And when I did, they said to me, we're looking for 13-year-olds like Justin Bieber when he started, so we could mold them. So think about, for example, WWE. If you're over 30 or whatever, it's not easy to break in. You know, they want those kids, you know, where they could mold them into the WWE style or whatnot. And age is a big thing in music and wrestling. What I find is there's a lot of similarities in any kind of show business, wrestling, boxing, music, acting. And I could sum it up very succinctly. 90% will never pay the bills, whatever the field is. 5% will pay the bills, but not be quote unquote rich and famous. And then there's that 5% that hit it big. And that could be an exaggeration. It might be 2, 3, 4%, but that small percentage is, you know, the John Cena's and Rock's and Austin's who you know, hit it huge and make crazy money. And that's the exception to the rule. And it's unfortunate. And then my ongoing issue with a $1 billion WWE is, how do you not give these guys pensions and 401ks and health insurance?
Long time ago,
What's that?
I said long time ago, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Billy Graham, who Hogan basically borrowed a chunk of his act, died needing a GoFundMe. Okay.
Yes. Goodness.
Bushwhacker Butch, who died around the same time, needed a GoFundMe. How disgraceful. The money these guys generated, you know, the gimmicks, their matches will show for eternity on the network, on Peacock or whatnot. How do you not take care of these guys? Even the NFL, who are despicable also, they have a fund for the legends. They have a fund for the old timers.
Yeah, for sure.
Because the old timers weren't paid what they should have been.
Exactly. Hey, before I give you over to Sign Guy, what do you got coming up here soon?
Coming up, we will release the John Tolos book in 2024. Kenny Casanova, who's put out all those great wrestling books, you know, Sabu and Kamala. Kenny Casanova's put out a ton of books, and it'll be with his company. And I'm also going to release a short story collection of, you know, just telling my life in 100 or so short stories. I basically wrote this when COVID was at its peak, just to stay sane, to have a positive project. It's called Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets. Because basically, I've spent my life involved with wrestling, teaching, and making movies. And there's multiple stories in there about the making of the wrestler and you know, just different experiences. I spent a weekend at the Iron Sheik's house. That story is in there. Can you imagine?
Awesome.
Can you imagine
what
that? Yeah. So it's really human interest stories. One story. It's 9/11, 2003, not 2001. 2 years later, on 9/11, by sheer coincidence, Johnny Valiant for a convention in Philly, and we took one of those little puddle jumpers from, which like a 20-seater from Philly to New York, okay? And it's 9/11. So it's still fresh on our minds 2 years later because New York was hit hard. And the pilot looked like Lee Van Cleef. The pilot looked like a bad guy in a movie, okay? And Johnny's looking at me, and I'm looking at him. And we're like, are we going to survive this? Or is this guy going to, like, plunge us into an ocean? So every time it hit a bump, you know, an air pocket, we're, like, freaking out. Like, this is it, Johnny. It's been nice knowing you. So in hindsight, it's funny. But that day, so these are all, like, human interest stories, being on the road with these guys. We did a convention in L.A., the Hollywood Collectors Show, famous convention, and it's mostly movie and TV stars. So we booked Iron Sheik and Nikolai and Greg Valentine and Jimmy Valiant, you know, Lanny Poffo. We have all these wrestling legends there, and we're taking the shuttle bus from the hotel back to the airport. And this woman gets on the shuttle bus, and she looks at Nikolai, and she goes, "You're Nikolai Volkoff." And Nikolai was just the friendliest, lovely guy. So Nikolai, "Yes, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you." So Nikolai goes, "Let me introduce you to my partner, the Iron Sheik." And Sheik looked exhausted, and he, you know, this was many years after his prime. She looks at the Iron Sheik, and she goes, "You're not the Iron Sheik." And he flipped out on her. He flipped out on the bus. He's like, "You stupid jabroni, get away from me." And she's like running to the front of the bus, you know. It's just like these stories, all these stories, like just being on the road with these guys, the good, the bad, and ugly of it, you know, fighting to get your pay from some of these dirtbag promoters indie promoters. And, yeah, man. So that book will be out probably later this year. The Tolos book, I think, will be out before. That's more in the finish stage.
Okay, right on. All right, well, Sign Guy?
Evan, we know from following you on social media, one of your all-time favorites is a wrestler that a lot of fans that have followed the current product more so than the history of the sport may not know necessarily, that being the Noble Gentleman. Can you tell us a little more on the Noble Gentleman that was around the WWWF in the 70s?
Yes. There was this very colorful wrestler, the Continental Nobleman, Joe Turco, okay? And basically, he would put over the stars on TV, and he pretty much did the same throughout the territories. But he had like this mustache that was like out of like the silent film era, and he would like twirl his mustache. He was just this great, great heel, just this great, great heel. So he's kind of forgotten to history, except for like old school WWF guys who, you know, saw him on TV week after week back 50 years ago, if not more. And he was not around during the Hulkamania era when it all exploded. So whenever I see like posts on the internet, just to amuse myself, somebody will say, who should have broken the Undertaker streak instead of Brock Lesnar? And I'll go, the Continental Nobleman, Joe Turco. And the fans are like befuddled. Like, who is this guy? Well, I'm just kidding. They don't even realize I'm joking. So we've managed to keep his name alive, the Continental Nobleman. And, yeah, it's funny. A lot of those guys, like SD Jones, for example, you know, he'd lose more than he'd win, but he'd put on a really good, solid match. So SD Jones would have the larger name, bigger name opponent in the corner, and SD would charge at him, and the opponent would, at the last second, dash out of the way. SD would, his head would hit the upper turnbuckle. Next thing you know, he'd be looking at the lights. And Monsoon, Gorilla Monsoon, would sadly say, SD went to the well once too often. This happened 10,000 times. You would think the guy would learn at some point, don't charge into the corner. But we were 10-year-old, 12-year-old marks. We had no idea. And we just loved these guys, Joe Turco, SD Jones, Johnny Rods. Let me tell you something. Johnny Rods was a better wrestler than three-quarters of the super heavyweight, you know, lumbering guys that Vince Sr. would bring in. Seriously, Johnny Rods was a tremendous wrestler. You might not know it from the one lost record, but tremendous. And then you have these guys who, you know, the fans kind of pigeonhole them. Oh, Iron Mike Sharp was just a loser. I go, that's not true. That's not true. He headlined all the territories, even WWF. He worked backland in main events, Philadelphia Spectrum, major arenas, you know. So they don't understand that these guys in different territories were main eventers. And even some of them, guys like Rene Goulet, these were Baron Cicluna, these were former tag team champions and former main event guys. But, you know, decades later, you know, they lose a step or two and they want to settle down and live in one area and not jump from territory to territory. And, you know, their roles changed. But I almost feel like the fans rewrite history. And, I mean, first of all, the jobber term is you know, insulting, because these guys, a lot of these guys were tremendous, tremendous wrestlers. And I would see them on TV in Florida or L.A. or whatnot, and these guys main evented. Johnny Rods main evented in L.A. Jabba Rook, he did a Sheik gimmick, original Sheik-type gimmick, you know, so... depending what territory they were, they had different roles. And a lot of these guys worked Japan and Australia and New Zealand. And, you know, it's really unfair decades later, because they just saw them in WWE, WWF at the time, later WWE, you know, where they were losing more. And it's not fair to write off their entire career like that. That's my speech for today. Anyway, guys.
Now, you were a wrestling fan when music was being integrated into entrances. It started well before your time, but was only an occasional thing with guys like Gorgeous George being played to the ring by a band and things of that nature. But by the late 70s and early 80s, certain wrestlers would have a musical entrance, like Sergeant Slaughter, the Freebirds, and so forth. Really, by the late 80s, pretty much everybody had a musical entrance. What did you think at the time as a fan of music being incorporated into the presentation?
It depended who was doing it and what the song was. It worked for the Freebirds, you know. They're coming into Lynyrd Skynyrd. You know who did it even earlier? Leroy Brown. Bad, bad Leroy Brown. He would come into the Jim Croce song. I would watch him in L.A. And when it worked, Jimmy Valiant, Boy from New York City. You know, when it worked, it worked. And other times, you know, if the song sounded kind of generic or cheesy, it didn't work as well. Another late friend, there's a laundry list of late friends. J.J. Maguire was Jimmy Hart's songwriting partner. And J.J. Maguire and Jimmy Hart wrote tons of music for the various wrestlers. When Shawn Michaels came into Sexy Boy or whatever the title was, that worked. That worked. Hulk Hogan, Real American, that worked. And other guys, it just was like generic, cheesy, you know, background music. And what I don't like is when there's an angle, when there's a match or an angle going on in the ring, and then you hear the guy's music. It kills the surprise. Why not just let the guy run out? You know what I'm saying?
Definitely. Usually have the music several seconds before the guy actually tries to run out to the ring.
Yeah, so there's no surprise whatsoever. What's the point of that? It actually kills the surprise. If you're in a heated match or a heated angle and all of a sudden some guy's furiously running down the aisle, that to me would be more exciting than you hear the music and there's a 10-second delay. I don't know. But yeah, it's like anything else. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes, you know, it's just corny. It's just generic and lame. But I don't think everybody and his mother need a theme song. I'll tell you something funny. I was at the AEW World's End pay-per-view live. It was at the Nassau Coliseum, which is like 20 minutes from my house. So they had a battle royale. And there was like 20, 22 or 24 guys, whatever it was. And the first 10 guys who were not stars just like walked out with no entrance music. So you immediately go, these guys aren't going to win. You know, it's almost like exposing the business. So then the other dozen or so guys, they were like higher on the pecking order. So they had their, you know, video and their entrance music. But the 10 other guys, in fact, they tossed one masked guy out of the ring. And I said to my friends, who is this guy? They didn't even announce their names. That's how absurd it was. They didn't want to go through 22 entrances because this was the pre-show and they didn't have the time. So 10 guys walk in the ring, you don't even know who it is unless you're like a fanatical fan of their watch. Yeah.
Now, also as a musical guy, were you a fan of a lot of the wrestlers that did novelty albums, guys like Jerry Lawler and Kamala and Ricky Morton that came out with musical albums either during the peak of their career or in Kamala's case several years after he stopped full-time wrestling?
Well, it's interesting. I used to do radio and TV, and we had Kamala on. He had basically retired, and he was an R&B singer, songwriter, and really good music. I mean, he was a legitimate musician. A lot of these wrestlers, they were basically just like talking through it. Like Fred Blassie did Pencil Neck Geek, which is like a great novelty song. And yeah, you know, Jimmy Hartigan and Jerry Lawler and Jimmy Valiant, you know, they would cut these songs, and they would sell it at the arenas, and they would make it was just a novelty item that made money for all of them. And I don't think they were shooting for high art for the most part, but I know that J.J. Maguire took great pride in those theme songs, and they got paid decently. You know, he was telling me they made sure, him and Jimmy Hart, that you know, they got their royalties and they got taken care of, because during that rock and wrestling era, that music was pivotal. I mean, that's what helped put it over, for better and worse, depending how you feel about it all. When it first changed, when Vince Jr. took over, when it first changed, I loved Piper. I loved Snooker. I loved Morocco, Bob Orton Jr. You know, these guys, Orndorff, tremendous. But by the late 80s, it had become like a kiddie show, and everybody was a character. And there's Dory Funk Jr., the former NWA champion, Hoss Funk. And there's Harley Race with a silly gimmick. And that I didn't really appreciate. And I lost interest. And at that point, I started going to the NWA shows in Philly, Baltimore, you know, in the East Coast. And I say to this day that the Crockett NWA shows, mid to late 80s, were the best live wrestling shows I ever saw in 50 years of attending. You had Flair on top. You had the Road Warriors, the Russians, you know, the Four Horsemen, Rock and Roll Express, Midnight Express. I think Midnight Express is as great as any tag team ever, if not the greatest. It was so talent-laden. They had guys like Billy Graham, Jimmy Valiant, Rick Rude, Manny Fernandez, mid-card. It was just this unbelievable talent roster, and they would wrestle their hearts out. And Flair, prime Flair, was unbelievable. The fans that go, oh, every match was the same, absolute nonsense. Flair Steamboat was the greatest match I've ever seen live. And Flair and Terry Funk, I was at the I Quit match. It was unbelievable. So, you know, if Flair fought a big muscle guy like Nikita Koloff, no, it wasn't the same match as Flair Steamboat. You have a lot, the guy's wrestling 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes. You'll see a lot of the same spots, but it's not the same match. That's also rewriting history unfairly. Hello?
You're breaking up.
Yeah, your phone is breaking up. I can't hear you, sorry.
Brother Stein. Okay, well, let me go to the studio. You might have lost him. He's still on there.
Okay,
all right, well, hey. Okay, there you go.
All right, sorry about that. Al, speaking of Flair and Funk, I was in Troy, New York, which had a really great crowd. It was a full building. But after that, nobody seemed to really run a major show in Troy, New York. Why do you think that was?
I'm just guessing. I mean, it's 35 years later. But once NWA went from Crockett to WCW and corporate, everything changed. They stopped running a lot of the same venues. They appeared less frequently. The shows weren't nearly as good. The shows, I went to see Flair wrestle El Gigante. You know, it just wasn't the same. It wasn't the same. And that's the only thing. A lot of times the attendance went down because the quality went down, and WWE, you know, could have been in the same geographic area and they were drawing a lot better. But I found that a lot of the live WCW shows that I saw, even in New York, they brought in Flair versus Savage, which Randy Savage, which sounds great on paper, but it was disappointing. They had both lost a step or two at the time. And I would guess that attendance was down in some of these places and they just stopped running. You know, it wasn't cost effective. You had these big salaries and they just didn't draw the way they had been drawing previously. I mean, with a few exceptions, but WCW, I had very mixed emotions. They had a lot of great, great talent, but a lot of it was circus-like, and eventually they went under. And now Eric Bischoff does a podcast where he attacks AEW, but he might want to look in the mirror because not what everything he did was magic either, you know?
Goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, as a wrestling historian, I know that you're probably aware of a lot of the great territories that the newer fans are not really familiar with, places like the Poffos ICW, the Los Angeles territory, the San Francisco territory. There's not a ton of footage that still exists on these places, but they were really big drawing territories at one point in time or another. In the Poffos case, a lot of talent that became superstars got their start there. What are some of the territories that you wish the more modern fans would study and learn about its history?
Well, off the top of my head, Memphis. Memphis was a great territory. The payoffs weren't necessarily great, but the territory was. I went down to Memphis in 1992 on vacation, and it was Lawler and Jeff Jarrett against the Moondogs, and they just brawled through the entire building, and it was wild. It was wild. You just wouldn't see that at Madison Square Garden, you know, a brawl up and down the stands, and, you know, it was a different kind of territory. The guys were smaller and faster for the most part, and Calgary, of course, with the Hearts, Dynamite Kid early on, and all that great talent up in Calgary. Toronto and Montreal, you know, they had tremendous, tremendous promotions, and they would sell 10,000 seats like it was nothing, show after show after show. The Sheik in Detroit, the original Sheik, you know, how many great houses did that guy have over decades in Detroit? Florida, of course, with Eddie Graham. The Graham family, that was a tremendous tragedy too, just like the Von Erichs in Texas. The Von Erichs and the Freebirds in Texas, and Gino Hernandez and Brody and all those guys. A lot of tragedy in Texas, boy. But a great, great territory at the time. I find it almost appalling when young fans go, oh, that old stuff was boring. You know, it was all 10-minute rest holds. They're clueless, clueless. San Francisco with Ray Stevens on top and Pat Patterson. Patterson took a lot from Stevens. Stevens really influenced them. I've interviewed many, many legends over the years, and many of them will say to me, prime Ray Stevens was the greatest wrestler of all time. the greatest of all time. So those who only saw him, you know, late in his career with the AWA or in the early 80s in WWF, you know, wrestling snooker, you know, they're not seeing prime Ray Stevens. And like you said, there's not a lot of footage. L.A., of course. L.A. was a magnificent territory. I mean, by the 80s, it was pretty much shot. But, you know, Tolis and Blassie, the feud was so huge. Tolis threw powder in Blassie's eyes and blinded him. Well, that was the angle. So Blassie, they actually sent to the hospital. They actually sent him, they put him in the hospital, like, overnight to sell the angle. And they wrestled in a stadium in front of 27,000 people. So when Triple H, you know, does the spiel, oh, Vince took all of this out of bingo halls and VFWs, you know, that's nonsense. I would go see Billy Graham at the Garden in the 70s, 22,000 people. And they would sell out the Felt Forum next door, closed circuit, $20 a ticket, which was a lot of money in the 70s, and 4,000 or 5,000 more people would pack that place. So you're looking again at like 26,000, 27,000 people. So it wasn't all bingo halls and VFWs, and you know, Vince. There's a good side and a bad side to it because I could count on two hands how many times I've been to a WWE show in the past 30, 35 years. It just doesn't. I'll tell you a funny story. I had comps to a WWE show a few years ago at the Garden, and I'm sitting there, and the Good Brothers come out. And instead of wrestling, they sing a song with Elias. They sing a song, you know, this great tag team. And I'm sitting there, it's like a sea of little kids, like kiddies with their parents. And it's like Pavlov's dogs. You guys were talking about the music. They pop to all the music. And I'm sitting there going, there's not a single match on here that's exciting to me. And about the middle of the show, I just said, this is too painful. This is where I saw Billy Graham and Bruno and Morocco. I was sitting in Madison Square Garden the night Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask came out in the early 80s, and this was a super heavyweight territory. And this was before the internet. You know, we didn't know what hit us. We sat there, our mouths were open. These guys were doing moves, you know, we couldn't have imagined. Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask. I was there the night Snuka jumped off the cage on Morocco. And as he jumped off the cage, there were thousands and thousands of flash cubes. That's how long ago this was. Flash cubes going off. And like that moment, I would say that was the greatest moment in wrestling history. Not necessarily the greatest match, but the greatest moment when he jumped off that cage. The fans like shrieked for like minutes afterwards. Like, and then Piper would come out during that era. And it was like 1 second to the next, you didn't know what he was going to do because he didn't know what he was going to do. It was just like chaos. And then like 10, 12, 15 minutes later, you could breathe again when the Piper match was over. It was like you held your breath. It was so exciting. And then you're sitting there, and they're singing. Okay, Elias is singing. And I'm like, this isn't for me. It's just not for me, which doesn't mean they don't have great matches here and there. Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins had a great couple of matches. And, you know, I don't mean to paint this dark picture, but, you know, I'm certainly not going to go to WrestleMania in Philly and spend hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. They have a VIP package ringside starting at $23,000. Starting at $23,000. I'm like, are you guys insane? Are you insane?
Absolutely.
I mean, unless you're like a millionaire, I mean, I've heard rumors that some of these fans are maxing out their credit cards, and it's like gambling or alcohol or any other addiction. They can't all be rich. They can't all be rich. They had a house show at Madison Square Garden right after Christmas. The prices were $63 to $479. $63 to $479 ringside for a house show, not even a pay-per-view, a house show. Where did people get this kind of money? Think about it. If you're a mom and dad with two kids, got four tickets plus trans plus gimmicks plus refreshments, food, whatever. You know, my friend went out with three kids and spent over $500 at an AEW show. $500.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, it's. So they can't all be rich. I mean, at some point, I think some people are going to max out their credit cards and be in trouble. Seriously.
Well, at this point, I'm going to throw things right back over to the coach with the most.
All right. Hey, Evan, do you got another 20 to 30 minutes, or how much time you got?
Yeah. Whatever you guys need. No problem.
Okay, cool. Now on to my ordinary questions. We would like to know, who was your heroes growing up, and that includes ordinary life?
As a kid of the 70s, that's how old I am, Bruce Lee, Bruno Sammartino, Superstar Billy Graham, Clint Eastwood. These were our Charles Bronson shooting muggers on New York trains in Death Wish. These were our heroes. And Bruce Lee died July 20th, 1973. And I was a kid at the time, and back then newspapers were still the standard way of getting news. The internet didn't exist. And I opened to like page 15 or something, and there was this little tiny obituary with Bruce Lee dying. And,
Jeez.
You know, I read it like four times. Like it wouldn't register because, you know, as a kid, this guy was Superman. We would see him in packed movie theaters, and the experience was unbelievable. And and what happens with all of these people who are your heroes, as you get older, you see the dark side. Bruce Lee died at his mistress's house, okay? Or he was carried out of his mistress's house the day he died. Muhammad Ali was a hero, and at a press conference, he introduces this woman as his wife, only it wasn't his wife, okay?
Oh.
And all the reporters are like, wait a second, that's not his wife. So, you know, you have these guys as like angels, and, you know, but I don't agree with a lot of Clint Eastwood's politics, et cetera, so on. But it does not negate the talent, the accomplishments, the body of work that they've made, that they've left behind, the influence, that they weren't flawless people. Monday is Martin Luther King Day. Martin Luther King was on the road like the rest was. And he had his share of groupies. I wouldn't call those women ring rats, but they were groupies or whatnot.
Yes.
So, but that does not negate what he accomplished in American society. So
Definitely.
As you get older, you realize your heroes were not flawless angels. And speaking of which, I'll tell you a really wild story. This is in my book also, my upcoming book. Madison Square Garden, December 8, 1980. It was like the only time Backlund was in Plymouth Wrestling in Japan. The main event was Sergeant Slaughter, who was an amazing heel, amazing Slaughter, prime Slaughter. Slaughter against Bruno on top. Backlund's not there. The shows would end about 11 o'clock because of curfew. They had curfew because union overtime at 11 o'clock cost a small fortune. So anyway, I walk out of Madison Square Garden, December 8, 1980. It's about 11 o'clock. I get out to the street. There's this really, really weird buzz. This weird, like people like murmuring, whispering. It was strange. It was like bees, like buzzing. I walk up to a total stranger, and these are my exact words. I go, "What happened?" And the guy goes, "John Lennon was just shot."
Oh, yeah, goodness.
I'll never forget it. So that's where, like, wrestling and, like, reality collided. It was right after the wrestling show, and it had just hit the news. There was no internet. It had just hit the news. We didn't know he was dead yet. The guy said John Lennon was shot. And after the fact, when he died, it was like a real, like, shame on New York. Like, as a lifelong New Yorker, we were really ashamed that it happened here, you know? So,
goodness, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so those were my heroes. Bruce Lee, George Clinton, the musician, James Brown, the musician, Bruno, superstar Billy Graham, Muhammad Ali. These were my heroes. As a kid, we also loved Evel Knievel. He was, like, absolutely insane. He would just, like, jump over things, break every bone in his body, get up, wave to the crowd. I was nuts.
Yeah, I know.
You know, we loved Evel Knievel as a kid. These were my heroes back in the day.
Hey, on a brighter note, I think there is hope for WWE now that they have new ownership compared to before when it was Vince's baby. You knew they were never going to have insurance. So hopefully that changes in the future.
I don't know. I mean, Dana White's another one like Vince. He doesn't spread the money around. I don't know. I mean,
well, that's true. They're starting to expose him on that. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. The, ruthless corporate vultures remain ruthless corporate vultures. And, Triple H to the fans, oh, he's the savior. I don't know. To me, Vince, 90% of what Vince pumped out was vanilla pablum, and 80% of what Triple H pumps out is vanilla pablum. I don't see, this is not Jim Crockett, the last four pay-per-views or premium live events, whatever they want to call it, I was sitting there, I was numb. It was stultifying. So, you have this unbelievable talent base. I'm not knocking the wrestlers. They have an unbelievable talent base. And for it to be utterly predictable, here's Roman Reigns. He barely wrestles. The Uso, Solo Sikoa or Uso, they're going to come out, interfere, he's going to win. It's like, how about a surprise here and there? How about an upset? How about, it's a corporate product. It's corporate wrestling. So, like I said, I very infrequently go to a WWE event. My friend went, and he's an old school fan. I said, let me ask you something. Was there one great match, one excellent match on that Garden card for $63 to $479? He goes, no. but the fans go home happy anyway. They got their entrance music. They see their favorites. They buy their gimmicks, and they walk out happy. So it, for them, it's not even about great wrestling. I went to the AEW pay-per-view. I'll tell you a funny story. You guys will appreciate this. So I'm sitting with my buddy, who's my age, and his nephew, who's like 21 or 2, and his buddy, who's like the same age. And my friend and I go back, you know, 40 years watching wrestling. I went back further than him, but he started going like early 80s. And we would take his nephew when he was a little kid to Ring of Honor at the Hammerstein at Manhattan Center in New York. And he'd see Nigel McGuinness against Bryan Danielson, you know, matches like this. And we would take the kid to Indies. We never took him to WWE. So he's sitting at the AEW show, and he thinks like us. He's like, there's nothing on here that great. There's nothing here that great. The entire show, a dozen matches, 4 or 5 hours. You know, it's too much. They slap together 8 guys. It's an eight-man tag, and, you know, silly angles. And it's like you got all these great, some all-time great guys on that show, like Jericho and Bryan Danielson. How is there not one great match the entire evening? Christian and Adam Copeland were the closest to a great match, but at the end, 37 people run out, and literally their mother, Nick's mom there, you know, I'm like, this is like WWE. It's a circus. You got two guys, you know, murdering each other. You know, let them wrestle. Why do you need all of this? You know, then they reverse the decision at the last second. I'm like, they basically killed the match for me. So, I'm more a purist. I want to see two guys, you know, in a feud, or two guys wrestling for a meaningful belt. Have a great match. I don't need to see 8 guys. Let me just add this for the listeners who have no idea who I am. I'm not one of those guys who go, there's been no good wrestling since the territories. That's not me. I love Ring of Honor. I love New Japan. I love AEW when they do things right. You know, AEW and ROH, you know, basically the same thing at this point. And when FDR wrestled the Briscoes, that was unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay? So it's not that I'm living in 1981. But much of what AEW does doesn't work, and much of what WWE does doesn't work for me. And, you know, let a guy like Bryan Danielson come out and create art. Create art. You know, I like Ospreay. You know, I like Omega. I think they're unbelievable. I'm not Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette, you know, they're just spot monkeys. You know, that's not me. And I love Cornette because I love the Midnight Express, and he was always great, but I don't necessarily agree with there's been no good wrestling in 40 years. I just don't see that at all.
Exactly. Hey, did you get to see Hendrix over there in New York back in the day?
No. He died like early 70s, and I was still a kid. Among the legends, I saw James Brown, Al Green, Marvin Gaye, Smokey, Diana Ross, all the jazz legends, you know, going back. So, yeah, you can't see everybody. Some of them I regret. I could have seen and I didn't. I should have seen Bob Marley. I should have seen David Bowie. I didn't. You regret. But I wish in hindsight I had gone to more of the territories. I went to Memphis. I went to Florida. You know, I went to various places, but there were some great territories that I never experienced, and it's a shame. I've, you know, looking back, I'll tell you a funny story. I went to England And this was back in the 90s. And they would have these indie shows at these resort towns, like these beach resort towns. And they would have guys dressed as WWE guys. So there's a British guy playing The Rock, and there's a British guy playing Mick Foley, you know? And all of a sudden they get on the mic and they have British accents. It was surreal. It was surreal. And you don't even know how legally they got away with this. But on the undercards, they would have like these old school, like British guys who could really wrestle that, you know, were wrestling under their own names. So like the main event is were the WWE imitators, and the undercard guys were like legit guys. And these venues, you could see like they had history, and they were like vaudeville theaters before that, you know, where you so again, wrestling is an art. When it's done well, it's an art. And when I see a guy like Brian, I keep going back to Brian Danielson because I think he's as great as anybody, Ospreay, Omega, you know, these guys, Okada, Tanahashi, I mean, these guys are artists. And when wrestling's done right, it's an art. And when it's done wrong, it's a circus. It's a circus. And
absolutely.
As an old school fan who's seen the best of the best, you know, it's almost painful. It's almost painful. Brock Lesnar's out there on a pay-per-view and he comes out in a tractor and he lifts the ring up. I'll go, and I just go, this is Vince's nightmare vision come to life. This is it.
I know. You know, it is. And think about it, that cost a lot of money for the production of that, bringing a tractor down there, running it through there, doing that. You know, you're wasting film. You know, it's like, goodness, man, it's like they can't do – there's 100 things they could have did better, yes.
Well, their story is we create moments. Well, if the moments are idiotic, you know, if the moments are geared towards 8-year-olds that fell on their heads as babies, it's not my moment, you know?
Exactly.
My moment, yeah, I'll tell you a moment. Billy Graham's wrestling Bruno at the Garden. Monsoon is the referee. Billy Graham makes like he's quitting. He goes back to the dressing room. Okay. Monsoon runs into the dressing room. Next thing you know, Billy Graham is on Monsoon's shoulders, and he dumps him in the ring, and Bruno pounces on him, and it's like a bloodbath. It's like the Roman Colosseum, 22,000 people, and thousands next door on closed circuit, where roaring like kill him, you know, kill him,
yeah,
like it's the Roman Colosseum. Okay, that's not a guy with a tractor, you know.
No, it was,
you know, it's just a different beast altogether.
Hey,
the guy in
the tractor can actually wrestle too, you know.
Oh yeah, I say to myself, if there's one guy in wrestling I wouldn't want to get angry at me, it's that guy, Brock Lesnar.
That guy will kill you
with his bare hands. So here's this guy who's so convincing. Just let him wrestle. You don't need all of that. Let him wrestle.
I know. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, this next segment is called Favorites. I'm sure Sign Guy and the rest of the fans would like to know what your favorite coffee to drink is if you drink coffee.
I'm not a coffee drinker. I'm a tea drinker, so I honestly couldn't answer that.
Okay, what's your favorite tea?
I like Bigelow. Bigelow, like not Bam Bam. It's a tea, and they have like different. This one's for like sinuses, allergies. This one's for upset stomach. It's like these magic potions. I like them.
Right on. And then, what have been your favorite concerts you've seen?
The greatest concert I ever saw, 1975, Al Green in his prime. He whipped the women into such a frenzy that they stormed the stage past security. It was like Elvis. So at one point, you couldn't even see Al Green on stage because there was a sea of women, like, molesting him. I'll never forget it. Al Green, 1975, greatest concert I ever saw.
Wow. And then in your lifetime, what have been your favorite sports teams?
Without any close second, it was the New York Knicks. 1969, 1973. The later version in 73 had Earl Monroe, who was the most dynamic player you could ever imagine, and Walt Frazier and Dave DeBuscher and Willis Reed and Bill Bradley. It was – my dad would take me to the Garden, and until I went to wrestling, I never heard – noise and heat like that. I mean, it was unbelievable. And again, jump ahead 50 years, literally 50 years, and the Knicks are a shambles, and the management of these disgusting corporate greed mongers, and the cheapest ticket in there is over $100, so they basically eliminated their blue-collar fans. And, you know, courtside are thousands of dollars. They basically eliminated their blue-collar fans. And when I went to wrestling at the Garden in the 70s with my dad never broke $25,000 as a New York City taxi driver. The tickets were $3 to $6. And when they went up to $4 to $7, everybody was complaining because it was like an economic hardship. Like, this was a real blue-collar crowd. Think about it. You had the Polish strongman, Ivan Putski. You had the Puerto Rican champion, Pedro Morales. You had the Italian strongman, Bruno. Everything was ethnic. You had Irish Davey O'Hannon. Basically, they were trying to draw in from this blue-collar crowd that did not have a lot of money to spend. And it was an escape. It was an escape from these hard jobs and difficult lives. And when I think of wrestling as a kid, it was some of the best nights of my life. Why? Because you went with your late father, my late father. He died in 1980. And it was very strange going afterwards without him. And I'd sit there and go, Dad would have loved this. You know, so some of the best nights of your life, with me, it was my father. With somebody else, it was their grandfather, their uncle, their mom, their aunt, whoever it was, you know, and they're gone now 50 years later. And you look back and you go, those were the best nights of my life, wrestling, the Knicks, concerts with your parents, with your family. They're not here anymore. So
I understand
when a younger parent, a 30, 40-year-old parent, takes their kids to the Garden and spends $200, $300, $400, $500, and the kid's in awe and the kid loves it and the kid's seeing it through a kid's eyes and the parent's happy that they're making their kid happy. I understand that, you know, totally. But at the same time, I don't like the corporate greed. The greed of it all, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah, don't suck every dollar out of these fans' pockets. So the Madison Square Garden used to be once a month and sometimes even twice a month. Now it's 3, 4, 5 times a year. Now it's a birthday present, a Christmas present, a graduation present because it's so expensive. Now it's like a special event. The whole thing has changed. It's changed. You could spin from here to tomorrow. Vince brought it all over the world and turned it into a $1 billion industry, but the product isn't as good.
Exactly.
And it's inaffordable to a lot of people.
Yeah, I know.
So,
okay.
Unaffordable or inaffordable? I'm tired. Inaffordable. Either or. You get what I'm saying. It's not affordable. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we're on our like last 15 minutes. I think Sign Guy has another question for you before he gives his plug.
Sure.
So you were coming up in an era where a lot of fans won't necessarily understand or relate to this, but there was a curfew at Madison Square Garden where if you were under a certain age, you were not allowed to attend the matches. They also had bans on women performing in Madison Square Garden as a wrestler. There was also a ban on masked wrestlers. So
yeah,
you could not see a masked wrestler until the mid to late 70s. Women's wrestling was not allowed there. And young fans were not allowed to attend. What was it like sort of coming up in that era where these bans were something that were real life and then seeing them start to become lifted and everything sort of becoming what it is now where there's not really restrictions as far as that goes at Madison Square Garden?
Well, what happened, the backstory is, way before my time in the 1950s, Dick the Bruiser started a riot at the Garden. He was wrestling Rocca. I think it was a tag team match, but I know it was Dick the Bruiser on one side and Rocca, probably Rocca and Perez on the other side. So Rocca, Rocca is like this beloved face, and Dick the Bruiser is a wild man, and they actually started a riot because fans believed we were marks, total marks. So basically, after that, they said no more kids. It's dangerous. They thought it was dangerous. So so I did not go to wrestling until I was 14 at the Garden, and. So then they had a ban on masked wrestlers, but it was a very strong Hispanic population in New York, and a lot of the fans were Hispanic, and they wanted to push Mil Máscaras. Okay, so Máscaras comes in with a mask. With a mask, because, you know, the strings were pulled, whatever had to be done. But prior, the Spoiler had to wrestle without a mask. And ironically, one night the Spoiler is wrestling Máscaras. Máscaras has a mask on and the Spoiler doesn't. Okay? That's politics for you. And El Olympico, who was an old school, you know, luchador, you know, he came in and he wore a mask, but they had to cut his face out. So you could see his face, but his head was covered with a mask. It was surreal, very, very strange. So anyway, so then for many, many years, the women were fighting to get in there. Moolah got the credit because she was in the first match, but there were others before her that fought to open those doors. And so that was lifted. And the curfew is still there, and I'll tell you why. At 11 o'clock, it becomes union overtime, and those guys get paid a fortune. So I'll give you an example. A few years back, I see Stevie Wonder at the Garden, and he's amazing, just amazing. So he starts the show at 8 o'clock, and like 5 to 11, he makes an announcement. He says, folks, it's going to cost me $40,000 in union overtime, but I'm not stopping. And then he played till 12:30 at night. He started at 8, he played till 12:30. But he paid out of his own pocket $40,000 in union overtime. And this was a few years back, so maybe even higher than that. So basically, you know, you got all these people working there. You got security and lights and sound, and if they stay past 11, you got to pay them whatever. You know, a lot more money. Like I said, 40 grand at least. So that's the story with that. So wrestling will still end before 11 o'clock. They're not going to go past 11 o'clock.
All right. Well, Coach, you want to get into things here as we wrap this down?
Yeah. Hey, Sign Guy, why don't you give us your plugs before I let you go?
All right. Well, you can find me on the Book of Faces, the Twitter, the Gram. Just look up Sign Guy. You will find it. Chicken Bob also on all the social medias. You can also find me over on the YouTubes, the Sign Guy 77. I will be back in a wrestling ring near me next Saturday. I will be in Linwood, Washington for Combat Pro Wrestling presents Theatrical Wrestling, and also coming up the next month on the 10th, I will be back for Northwest Pro, 10th of February in Vaughan, Washington. The following week, back for Combat Pro in Linwood, and then on the 24th, I shall make my way back to Ocean Shores, Washington, for Rogue Wrestling Attractions, which apparently just started on local television in Ocean Shores. So if you are unable to attend live, you got the option of watching on television there. And on Turnbuckle Turmoil tomorrow, a Buddha special time of 6 p.m. Pacific, we have the Drip Goat Cosmo joining us. And on next Friday on Sun Guys Wrestling Show, we are delighted to have the return of Texas-based independent star Reggie Lincoln. So that's what I have happening in the next several weeks.
Right on. Thank you, Sun Guy. Appreciate you. He hung up. Okay, Evan.
I guess so.
What are your suggestions for people wanting to get into the business?
Oh, my God. Network. Promote yourself. Instead of sitting on Facebook talking about Raw and SmackDown, promote your appearances. Promote your bookings. Buy merch and make some money at the gimmick table instead of, a hot dog and a handshake or whatnot. It's a very tough business. I've seen more people leave it unwell than well. But at the same time, I knew Mick Foley when he was sleeping in cars and working indies for $50, and he became a millionaire. So there's always that chance. So if you get your foot in the door, maximize it and network like crazy and be a professional. It's a sport. It's have business cards and have promo videos and have something to give, promoters, that will entice them to book you. And again, promote your bookings. Promote. There's 50 things to do in any given major city in America on any Friday or Saturday night. Make them want to come and see you. Why is this special? Okay. Cut promos. A lot of these indie guys, I hate to use the word lazy because they're certainly not lazy, taking bumps and going through hell. They're not lazy on that end, but as far as promotion, many of them are lazy. So if you want to make it in wrestling, network, promote, and don't get involved with the drama. This promoter hates that promoter. This wrestler hates. Forget about all that nonsense. And look like a wrestler. A lot of, I'm an old guy. I'm 6'2", 214. I'm in decent shape. If you're 21 years old, be in shape. If you ever want any chance to make it, in the business, come on, have some this. When this interview is over, I'm heading to the gym, and I'm not a wrestler. Just pride, pride and appearance. Come on,
Yes, for sure. And then, what schools would you like to suggest if you have any?
Oh, go to legitimate guys like Johnny Rods. Legitimate guys. Guys that have made it. Sometimes you have guys who really are not qualified to be teaching, but they just had the money to set it up. Johnny Rods has, trained some of the best guys in the business. In earlier decades, of course, I'd say go to Killer Kowalski. My point being, he's long gone. He was a dear friend of mine. Go to legitimate people, not only will they train you right, they'll have better connections for you, to take it to the next level.
Absolutely.
I have a love-hate. I have a love-hate relationship with everything wrestling. Everything.
Well, yes, you got standards, my goodness, and they do not hold up to your standards. We know that. I know that from being your friend on Facebook for so long.
I appreciate it. Speaking of standards, I saw the Iron Claw, and there's some powerful moments in that movie. Oh my God, it's like it's rough though. It's a rough watch. It's one tragedy after another, as you know. But there's some great acting, and there's some really powerful and brutal moments in that movie. Have I seen better movies? Yes, it has its flaws, but it's a damn good movie. Go see it. It's worth 2 hours of your time. Yeah.
I haven't got to see it yet, but you know, me and my girl go to see movies all the time, and I told her, yes, I want to go see this movie, but I don't think she should go with me.
Oh, it's brutal. You know what's going to happen as a wrestling fan. So it's like you're watching the Titanic and you're waiting for the boat to sink. Oh my God, this is not an easy film. There's some really, really painful, and not all of it. The mother at one point, there's a scene where she says how painful it is for her to put on the same black dress to bury another son. Oh my God.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
You know, there's moments like that just stay with you after the film. It's just heart wrenching. So, you know, it has its issues, but, all in all, I would say check it out. And, I did a movie about 20 years ago. It's called Wrestling Then and Now, and we just re-released it to Tubi and Amazon, different platforms. Killer Kowalski, Nikolai Volkoff, Don Arnold, who was a great, great wrestler in his day. He was Dr. Death in L.A., but he was a big star in all the territories, Don Arnold. And 20 years later, I watched this movie, and these are all my friends, and they're gone. They're gone, you know? So
yeah,
you're never gonna get rich off a documentary. But to me, I'm just so happy that, you know, you're preserving them as people. You know, it's not so much them in the ring. You're seeing them outside the ring, and they're interesting, colorful, intelligent, warm people. And check it out, Wrestling Then and Now. I think you'll enjoy it. And if you like wrestling history, I'm the senior editor at Pro Wrestling Stories. We have about 900 articles on there, 900. Basically, you bring up any name in the history of wrestling, there's a pretty good chance they're on there, as well as Jim Phillips, who's a good guy. Jim Phillips is a historian. He covers all the old territories. And I mean, not just the biggest, like WWA, you know, like not just Florida and Memphis, but he covers all the territories in detail, prowrestlingstories.com. And I think the old school fans will, and I'm sure some of the younger fans, if they want to learn their history. I mean, I started watching in 1972, and I started going in 74. I mean, there's a lot of history I don't know, and sometimes I enjoy reading about it and learning about it, especially, you know, it's funny. My mother was a wrestling fan in the 1950s, So she saw a lot of the same guys I saw in the 70s. She would go, I saw Haystacks Calhoun. I saw Killer Kowalski. She couldn't wrap her head around the fact that Killer Kowalski was my friend, because she saw him as like the most evil guy in the world. You know, she was a kid watching him in the 1950s. So, yeah, it's funny when you get to know these guys. Killer Kowalski, on a personal level, he was almost shy. He would sit there and not say anything unless you asked the question first. He was shy, Killer Kowalski.
Wow.
And I'll, for those fans who don't know it, I'll give you the 30-second version of the most famous Killer Kowalski story. Kowalski's wrestling Yukon Eric. He jumps off the top rope. Yukon Eric's ear was, like, really badly cauliflowered. So Kowalski accidentally, his knee hits Yukon Eric's ear, rips it off in the ring. The ear comes off in the ring. Okay, the punchline to the story. Kowalski was the sweetest guy in the world. He goes to visit Yukon Eric in the hospital. He felt terrible. You never want to hurt the guy you're working with. He felt terrible. So he goes into Yukon Eric's room at the hospital, and there's a couple of other guys there. Kowalski doesn't know them. And his entire head is wrapped up with bandages because his ear was ripped off. Okay? So Kowalski looks at him and he thinks to himself, he told me this story. He said, he looked like Humpty Dumpty. And I started laughing because he looked so bizarre with his entire head bandaged like that. He looked like Humpty Dumpty. So Kowalski had no idea that the guys sitting in the room were reporters, and they reported that Killer Kowalski came to the hospital to mock Yukon Eric, and overnight he became like the biggest heel in pro wrestling. That's a great story. That's a true story from Kowalski's mouth himself. Yeah.
Definitely
so,
awesome.
Yeah, man.
Right.
Kowalski. Kowalski, top 10 heel of all time, maybe top 5. Unbelievable. Unbelievable, that guy. Yep.
And he looked like it, too, you know? My goodness.
Oh, he looked like a heel. He looked like a heel. And him and Bruno wrestled hundreds and hundreds of times, always drew, always had great matches. I'll leave you guys with this. When I've interviewed legends on various shows and for various media over the years, the guys the legends revere, it's always the same names. They go Prime Ray Stevens, Holly Race, Lou Thesz, Nick Bockwinkel, Killer Kowalski, Ivan Koloff. Those are the names that always come up from the legends themselves. And they'll say Bruno, not that he was a great, great wrestler, but he was a great, great person and a great draw. Okay, Bruno was meat and potatoes, you know, punch, kick, bear hug, you know, but they revered him as a person because he was a good human being and he looked out for the other wrestlers. So those are the names that always come up. And why not Flair and Pat Patterson, who were also great? Because they looked at it as, Buddy Rogers is one of the all-time greats also, top five. But they always brought up Buddy Rogers because they always said that Flair copied Rogers and that Patterson copied Stevens, even though they were both great. But the guys they revered were the guys that I mentioned. And I was lucky to see them in the 70s and 80s, most of them, you know, when they were still great. And I cherish those nights. I cherish those memories, and try to preserve them. 350 days. Like I said, we have 36 legends, and it's heartbreaking because most of them are gone now. One after another. Even you watch that movie 5 years later, and The majority of the cast are gone. George Steele, Lanny Poffo, The Wolfman, Larry Sharp, Mosca. They're gone.
Exactly.
Billy Graham. I can't wrap my head around Billy Graham being gone because he was so iconic in New York. And I can't wrap my head around Terry Funk being gone. He wasn't in the movie. But Terry Funk, that guy was so great. So charismatic. You can't even fathom he's not with us anymore. Same with Piper. Same with Snuka.
Exactly.
These guys were so off the charts charismatic. I watched them on video, and it's like a disconnect. It's like you're seeing it live. You can't imagine these guys are dead and buried. You can't. But that's the beauty of it. Their art will live forever, forever. 100 years from now, people will be watching a Roddy Piper match. That's the beauty of creating art.
Exactly. So, hey, how do people get a hold of you?
What's that?
How do people get a hold of you?
I think the easiest, come to my Evan Ginsberg's old school memories page, Evan Ginsberg's old school wrestling memories page on Facebook. I think that would be the easiest way. You can message me there, because otherwise I'm kind of all over the place. But I would, Evan Ginsberg's old school wrestling memories, I think that would be the easiest way to do it. And I think they'll enjoy it. There's a lot of content, a lot of conversation like we've been having today. And the other day, The Undertaker said his Mount Rushmore of big men included Kane. And I go, no. Kowalski, Ernie Ladd, Don Leo Jonathan, Kane. Okay? These are the kind of conversations we have on that page. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. And then what about your podcast?
I am not doing a regular podcast now, but I'm a special guest host pretty regularly on Wrestling and Everything Coast to Coast. Wrestling and Everything Coast to Coast. And we also have had a lot of cool guys on there like Lanny Poffo. R.I.P., man. I love that guy. That guy slept on my couch many times.
Yes.
I booked him. What a beautiful person, man. It
yes.
breaks my heart. It breaks my heart. And he was a health nut. I'm telling you, this guy would not put a bad, junk food, nothing. It was shocking,
wow. Shocking
Goodness. That he's gone,
yeah.
You know?
Nikolai
was vegan. Nikolai would not eat anything unhealthy, and it was shocking when he was gone. If somebody years ago had said, Evan, I'll bet you $10,000 that Iron Sheik would outlive Nikolai, I would have taken that bet and lost. Can you imagine the Iron Sheik outlived Nikolai? This guy, oh, man, I'll tell you. Wrestling.
Well, yeah, geez. Yes, definitely.
I mean, these were my friends. These were my friends, all of them, and one by one, they're gone. So you got to preserve the memories, and we do our best anyway. It's painful. It's painful to lose these guys. So anyway. And thank you guys for what you do. Seriously, you have a long running quality show, and it, it's some of these shows are so generic. They just cover the same exact stuff as 1,000 other shows. You guys have done. I've been on your show before. You guys have done quality work for years, and much respect to you guys also. Seriously.
Yes, thank you so much, Evan. We appreciate you and everything you've done for wrestling. Your outlook. Just everything. We appreciate you so much, and thanks. And I wish you all the luck in the world.
My pleasure, guys. And anytime you need me, I'm happy to come on. And support Indie Everything. Support the coaches indie bookings. Seriously, buy it. WWE doesn't need your money. The indies do. Support Indie Everything. I'm leaving you with that. Take care, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Evan Ginsberg. Man, we appreciate him so much and for his time and for the interview. And I want to tell you guys that next week I have Rampage Radisson on. And then on the end of the month, I got Sam Sims will be with me. Then I'm looking to get my February schedule going here soon. You guys can check me out at Coach Mike Jones, the coach with the most. Coach Mike Jones on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. Don't forget to check out the Real School Army and the NGW Green Room for hundreds of interviews from celebrities all over the world. And also, here's Joe Love and the Never Were with Coach Mike Jones' walk-on song. Thank you so much. We love you and appreciate everything. Thank you.
That's right, everybody. You know who it is. Coach Mike Jones on the coach with the most. Coming at you hard from coast to coast. I don't want to boast, but now I got to roast you in my social media posts. You double dose, undiagnosed. You feeling tired, life inspired, now you're a ghost. I'll be your host, so won't you raise a toast to the coach with the most, Coach Mike Jones.
Everybody say coach, coach. Everybody say-